Commencing realignment sequence. Thank you.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me, C.S.E. Cooney, or you can call her Claire, and Carlos Fernandez. Claire Reed, Carlos Fernandez. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, I tried. I unfortunately wasn't able to make it to a screening of A Monster Calls this week, but I've been sent a lot of video screeners from publicists, so there has to be something worthy of note in that pile of films that's opening now, right? Well, let's go through a few of them. The interesting thing about Go North is that one of its executive producers is Morgan Spurlock. That may mean that there's an ulterior motive to the fact that this post-apocalyptic teen adventure was shot entirely on location in Detroit. God knows the present-day city that director Matthew Ogens leverages for his near-future scenario is, sadly, all too convincing as a backdrop for the wreckage of civilization. And the scenario he comes up with, in which some unspecified contagion wipes out all adults, and the survivors, children and teens, have gathered into a community in which the high school jocks conscript their peers as slave labor, has potential. Unfortunately, Ogens, who also co-scripted, doesn't delve deeply into the dynamics that would result, instead opting for the kind of moony wish-fulfillment fantasy an especially callow teen boy might concoct, in which an equally callow protagonist, played by Jacob Laughlin, convinces the cutest girl in school, played by Sophie Kennedy Clark, to run away with him in search of a vaguely defined refuge from their oppression. They are aided by a benevolent, if not particularly magical, Negro, played by Matthew Love, the best performance in the film, by the way, and confront some decidedly low-stakes life-or-death situations. I frankly think that Lord of the Flies had it right in what would happen if kids were left to fend for themselves. For that matter, the Star Trek episode Mary casts a more convincing Planet of the Kids scenario than what we get with Go North. While we're talking about teenage wastelands, there's also Bad Kids of Crestview Academy. This is a sequel to Bad Kids Go to Hell, a kind of hyperbolic 10 Little Indians meets the Breakfast Club exercise that, for me, was notable for the fact that I can't remember anything notable about it. One of the featured players of that previous film, Ben Browder, takes up the director's chair for this follow-up, which, like the previous film, is based on a series of graphic novels. Browder, of course, is best known for his lead roles in TV shows such as Farscape and Stargate SG-1, and for the comedic spin he likes to bring to such roles. He tries to bring that kind of energy to Crestview Academy, But he's like an Orson Welles with no impulse control. All canted Dutch angles and mismatched color schemes for his cinematography, pointless shifts into comic book-like animation for the murder sequences, Rashomon-style flashbacks that don't much add complexity to the mystery of the suicide or possibly murder of a student as confusion, and characters that can barely raise interest in the audience, much less empathy, including the sister of the victim, played by Sammy Hanratty, who's out to find the murderer by embedding herself with a group of privileged students serving detention in the aftermath of the death. Like the previous film, Bad Kids of Crestview Academy makes nods towards class warfare, but gums it up with sinister conspiracies that make little to no sense. This wasn't much fun, and in a film where most of the male leads are hunks and most of the female leads wear their school uniform blouses tied off at the waist, that's a criminal failure. And then there's Attack of the Lederhosen Zombies. Yes, that's a real film. I've only watched 20 minutes of it. It's set in an Austrian ski resort where some experimental artificial snow solution starts turning people into zombies. It is what it is so far. Enough said. That leaves us with Ocean Waves, which is not a genre film, but is notable for being out of the legendary Japanese animation house Studio Ghibli, for finally getting its U.S. release 24 years after its debut, and for being the first film from the studio not to be directed by Hayao Miyazaki or Isao Takahata. Told in flashbacks, it's the tale of a high school boy, Taku, who tries to contend with the moods and caprices of a particularly difficult girl, Rikako. It's a beautifully observed study of a young man being brought out of his self-involvement into an understanding of the needs and complexities of others. There's some growth, some sweetly humorous moments, a lot of interesting insight into Japanese high school culture circa 1993, and since it's the last film I watched before writing this review segment, it pretty much salvaged my growing fear about what 2017 may hold in store. Ocean Waves is charming, it's honest, it once again reveals that animation can delve surprising depths. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Well, that was shorter than I was expecting, Dan, but that's all right. Last week, he went like 10 minutes, because it was the end of the year show. Now, is my mic even? No, my mic is like barely on. I've got the pot all the way up. Wow, and it's barely on. Wow, I'm practically, shall I say it? No, I won't say it. Horrible, horrible reference I would make to what mics look like and stuff like that, and what it looks like when you're talking too close into a microphone. But forget all that. Let's see. Good morning, everybody. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I really suggest that you come to our reading last night, because it was really good, with Shannon Chakraborty and Fenderson Jelly Clark, and hosted by Rob Cameron, or Cam Roberson, depending on which way he is standing at the moment.
Which is the evil one again?
Both.
Just both. To keep it clear.
Yeah. Yeah, both
that makes it easy, actually.
Absolutely evil. Yeah. He actually was on the show last week, and he read his short story from Clockwork Phoenix 5.
Oh, excellent, the ghost story.
Yes, yes, really nice story. Say that again.
Oh, it was his excellent ghost story.
It yes, now, but now your mic is on.
Well, that's nice.
Which it wasn't the first time. It's like, I don't know how they wire this room. I'm used to consoles instead of mixing boards, but let's not go there, shall we? We're living in an alternate universe. You know, as of last November, it went even more alternate than, or alt-right than anybody can deal with. I can't deal with it, so I just escape. Who am you anyway? Claire, why don't you introduce the person to your right?
The person to my right is Carlos Alberto Pablo Hernandez, PhD. I call him Dr. Dr. Pants. Yes. Or anything ending in pants.
I didn't know that you had an Alberto. My middle name is Albert.
Oh, look at that. We're practically brothers.
And where they came up with Albert, well, I guess
it means
German.
It's Elfbright, right? It's a definitely Germanic, and it's...
Well, I'm last name is Freund, so that's pretty German, yeah.
And I'm 1/16th German, I think. I think just going up my line, there was a German grandmother somewhere in there. So.
But it's a very fantastic name, fantastical in its roots, and it makes sense that both of you are here tonight.
Yeah, I guess so. So the Albert Club, the Albert Middle Name Club, and just before the TV series Victoria is about to begin on PBS.
Hmm.
But you don't have a TV, so you don't know it. But
I'm not very much of a big Victoria head.
It's, well, do you do Who at all?
Doctor Who? I know that the young woman who is in Doctor Who is in it. I enjoyed a few of her performances, but I'm not crazy about her.
She's very, very good in this.
She's very sparkly and bright.
This is good for her because it's a little darker.
That's great,
And she's done darker roles before Doctor Who.
I'm sure she'll be wonderful.
Yeah.
I just don't necessarily need to watch it.
I've actually watched it already,
Excellent.
The whole series.
And did you enjoy it very much?
I enjoyed it a lot.
Good.
I think The Crown is a little bit better,
but
The Crown has such an incredible cast from beginning to end. And speaking of Doctor Who, Matt Smith playing Prince Philip.
I do like Matt Smith.
Yeah, I like
him. He is, the co-stars are Claire Foy and Matt Smith. And then John Lithgow plays Winston Churchill and on and on and on. Lithgow used to work here.
I like that Matt Smith is a young man who should be an old man. Like, he already has an old man in his eyes, and he acts more with his hands. Like, he's a very physical actor.
Yes.
He'll rather, like, turn a cartwheel to express joy than express joy verbally. And I sort of like that about him. He's a good clown, and he's like an old man clown in a young man's body.
He's very gangly.
Yes.
Is the word that I used ever since I first saw him in, what was it? It was an adventure, I think, written by Philip Pullman.
Oh, yes. It was his mystery series,
yes.
Ruby and Smoke.
That's it, yeah.
I love those books, and I was very excited to see that they had been adapted. I only ever got to see the first one, but
there were only two.
But there are three books.
There were only two TV.
I gotcha.
Sorry, go on. I interrupted.
No, I just very much enjoyed the books, and I liked that Matt Smith was in the adaptation. And so is the girl who plays Rose.
Right. Billy Piper,
yes.
Yes, and she was quite good in that. There are things that she's done in which she was not quite good. But Matt Smith was the co-star in that.
He was the reporter, the journalist.
The reporter, exactly. And he was a lot of fun. So when they announced him as the doctor, I actually knew who he was.
I know, me too. And that was the only thing I knew him from years before that. Maybe it was 3 or 4 years, and I'd not seen hide nor hair of him since. But, yeah, because I so very rarely know actors.
And if anybody just, and then we'll get off the topic, if anybody is a current Who fan, see the movie Local Hero, which is from, I guess, the early 80s. It was a wonderful movie directed by Bill Forsyth, starring Burt Lancaster in one of his last roles, and he's charming in it, and a very young Peter Capaldi, and he is wonderful in that. So he's been around a very long time, and I like him as the doctor. I've actually liked all the new doctors.
My roommate and I have been watching the Musketeers television series. It's such swashbuckling fun, and Peter Capaldi as Cardinal Richelieu. It's amazing.
Leaving no piece of scenery unchewed.
I know, but I like an actor who chews the scenery. It's just more interesting.
Yeah, well, he does that on Who, too.
Yes.
I haven't seen it yet, but Claire keeps threatening to dress me up as one or more of the Musketeers.
The curly-haired one.
Oh, I only watched the pilot.
Porthos. I want him to dress like Porthos.
Okay.
Yes, with an earring.
And I'm probably going to say yes.
And I would like that.
At what occasion?
All the occasions. All the occasions. Please.
Probably ReaderCon, though.
Yeah, but billowy. Ooh, okay. And leathery with earring and curly hair. Yes. And a sword. A big sword.
I probably should introduce the person to my left.
I was about to ask you to do that.
So the person to my left is Claire Suzanne Elizabeth Cooney. You'll know her in her writing as C.S.E. Cooney. And she is the 2016 winner of the World Fantasy Award for her collection, Bone Swans. The title story, the
published
Bone Swans, published by Mike Allen and Clockwork Phoenix. It's Mythic Delirium Press, who also publishes the Clockwork Phoenix series. Claire's title story, The Bone Swans of Amandale, was nominated for a Nebula Award as well. And so Claire comes onto the show storied already.
Man, I didn't give you a very professional introduction. Carlos Hernandez is also the author of The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria, which is one of the most marvelous collections of short stories that I've read in the past 5 years or so.
But enough about me. Let's talk about how wonderful your collection is.
Oh, no.
Which is...
I'm just going to leave this room and close the door.
Can you flip on some 70s music on the way out?
I can.
Who needs 70s music when we've got you, Hernandez?
No.
You asked us on the show, man.
He could have stayed at home and slept at this hour.
While this radio station is very undersupplied, we do have a bucket of cold water somewhere.
Isn't it still raining outside? Go soak your head.
I'll just turn my umbrella upside down. My brolly. It's wonderful. Now, when I first saw the two of you reading, I had not met you. I didn't really meet you until last April 5th, when at the Clockwork Phoenix launch party reading that we did here. And Carlos I already knew, he was in a writer's group with my partner.
Yes.
Tabula Rasa.
Tabula Rasa.
Another fine writer.
She is. She is that. And we need to mention for everybody in this room and for Barbara Krasnoff that if you were a member of the Worldcon last year, then you are entitled to nominate for Hugo Award stories now. The nominations just opened. So if you were a member in 2016, either supporting member or active member, attending member of the Worldcon, you could vote for a story in Bone Swans. You could vote for a story. Which would you choose? If there's one story, one foot forward, Carlos.
So the Magical Properties of Unicorn Ivory was included in the best of Rich Horton's best of. So I think that would be the one that I'd put forward there.
And Barbara's story from Clockwork Phoenix, Sabbath Wine, is one of her best stories, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, that
Barbara,
was one that I got to workshop.
You're not supposed to be awake now, Barbara.
But I was in Tabula Rasa when we workshopped that, so I remember that story fondly and was glad to see it in Clockwork Phoenix 5.
So, listeners at home, if you are eligible to vote, you can make up your own minds. Oop, I just made a mistake signing into the computer. I just told it to log me in every time. That's bad.
Oh, dear.
I don't need people using my Google account.
Oh, dear.
At any rate, so Claire doesn't actually live in New York, but you come here. Frequently enough, and we had arranged...
Not frequently enough. Come more frequently.
We're working on it.
Okay. She comes here sporadically enough so that you were actually here for the weekend, and I was going to try to record an interview with you yesterday before the NYRSF reading.
But you were sick, poor thing.
I wasn't feeling well. I am somewhat better. Barbara brought home a cold from... going to the Consumer Electronics Show, and I took it from her, being the kind soul that I am. And I think we're both better now.
Excellent. I'm glad it was a quick one.
But it was also, I was engineering. I did the video engineering last night. And if people, by the way, want to go to the, well, to ourwolf.com and look at the Nursef readings there, that will take you, you can actually see last night's reading, or you could see the, highly recommend the April 5th. That was a great event. Clockwork Phoenix 5 launch party, where we had 8 readers, including Rob, who hosted last night, and the two of you in, now what's the word? Epistolary?
An epistolary short story called The Book of May. It was our first collaboration at the very beginning of our friendship, and it certainly made us very fast and deep friends very quickly.
And Barbara read a small segment from Sabbath Wine.
Yes. Got me hooked.
Yeah. It's a good story. It's yes. Real good. The end of it is like, wow. But anyway, Carlos has been on the show before. You're a newbie. We're going to have you each at other times. But so this is a glad to have you together. And Carlos is free and will continue to talk during the show. But yes. This is but Claire will be the reader in about 20 minutes. And you are a professional.
Yes, I'm an audiobook narrator. I've worked for Tantor Audio, and I've worked for Highbridge. They're both under the umbrella of recorded books. I've narrated over 50 books so far, but I've only been doing it a year and a half.
Only, yeah.
So I hope that it will be a long career. It certainly is a glorious one from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I just last week got to narrate Bone Swans, my own book.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did. So
for where?
For Tantor. After I won the award, they emailed me.
Oh, yes, we had this conversation.
And
yeah,
they said, Claire, do you have the rights? And I said, yes, I have the rights. And they said, would you like to record it? And I said, I was only just going to do a DIY version. So, of course, I'll come in and have everybody take care of the proofing and the editing and the engineering for me. It really was one of the epic, impossible dreams that came true. They had it because of page count. They predicted it was going to be about 8 hours, recorded hours long. And by the end of the first day, I had a feeling it wasn't going to be. It ended up being 3 minutes from 12 hours long because of the density of my pages. I realized what a dense page I wrote, in fact, when I was narrating my own book.
Yeah, but it's short stories.
They're 5 novellas.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oops. Why? Excuse me. My phone is supposed to mute. Okay. I'm going to mute the darned thing, the little scamp right now. It doesn't want to. It doesn't want to. I'm sorry.
Don't put me down. Let me keep my voice. Please, save us.
It has a voice. It has occasionally, my phone is a Motorola X, or otherwise known as a Moto. And with this particular model, when it came out, it's already 3 years old, it's ancient. You can name you don't have to say, hi, Google, to get it going. You can just call it whatever you want. So this phone is called, I have to cover it so it doesn't hear me, Mr. Moto. And when I say Mr. Moto, it just did it. It just did it. It then shows up and says, hi, Jim. And then I have to quickly stop it. Oops, I missed it. Or else it starts talking and saying, I'm sorry. So in the middle of a show, somebody asked what some of my favorite Peter Lorre roles were, and I said it, not realizing all of a sudden the phone in my bag bleeped. And then my bag started saying, I'm sorry, Jim, I didn't understand what you were saying.
Damn it, Jim, I'm a phone, not a doctor.
At least it didn't start correcting you. That's nice. No, Matt Smith was the eighth doctor.
Yes. So there are other people that do that. So that's way cool. A few years ago, it was unheard of for a writer to be able to narrate their own book.
That's interesting. Because a few years ago, I was in my kitchen in Chicago listening to Neil Gaiman narrate Fragile Things and having a nervous breakdown on the floor. So I am used to the thought of an author reading their own work, but it sort of seems like a special case. I know Ellen Kushner does it.
Well, Ellen Kushner has a background at NPR.
And Libba Bray, I think, narrated Drama Queen. What's the Queen's one that she wrote? And she won the Audie for it.
I'm not sure.
Oh, I should know this. I've heard it 1,000 times, but has the word Queens in it, and Libba Bray wrote and narrated and won an award.
Well, here on Hour of the Wolf, we specialize in the author's voice. now, I work to a more limited extent in the audiobook industry as well as an audio editor. And I'm also host of Lightspeed Magazine, which I also do the audio editing of. But this has not yet crossed paths with Tantor books. But we may try to, the three of us, cross each other's paths in audiobook land. But I just wanted to say that there is no conflict of interest here. But on Hour of the Wolf, when I came to BAI in 1967, Chip Delaney was producing a radio drama of his own devisement, The Star Pit, which went on to win the Nebula Award. The printed version of The Star Pit did win the Nebula, but he was doing a dramatic reading slash radio drama here. And that is what got me hooked on the idea of writers reading their own work. And when Margot Adler started Hour of the Wolf, and I was her co-host 2 days a week, I started bringing in writers for her. And that's sort of how it started. And I'm very proud of having writers read their own work.
I think it's wonderful.
It is. It is. Not every writer is cut out for it. So I actually teach a course at SIFWA, at Science Fiction Writers of America, functions and places, and various. I did it at ReaderCon.
My friend Caitlin and I have taught a workshop at ReaderCon twice called From Page to Stage, because we both have backgrounds in theater, and we have, and it was surprising the interest that came of it, and we thought it was a very useful thing to teach, you know, just even the basics of breathing and a couple of warming up exercises, a couple of ways to shatter the nerves a little bit, shatter the nervous energy and prepare yourself, because we take it for granted because we've been in theater classes since we were little, you know, but I think some people were just never taught how to breathe.
I took a course in that at a ReaderCon from Andrea Hairston.
Yes, she's taught it too. She's wonderful, isn't
she's
she?
She's brilliant. She really
is. I love watching her, and I think her name is Pam Morrigan. I just wanted to say it's Beauty Queens by Libba Bray. I'm sorry that I didn't have the correct title before.
But one of the things I would say about that is that there are two different things going on with writers reading their own work. One is the performativity, you know, and their ability to theatrically, you know, create their work in voice. But then the other thing is writing a page that can be delivered well in the air as well. And one of the things that Claire and I have been doing a lot lately is just reading work aloud to each other, both our own prose and just other books. Right now we're reading The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay out loud. And
it's amazing.
It is an amazing book in the air, and I think many of your listeners would agree it's just amazing, period. But in the air it's amazing also, and it just speaks to a certain kind of editing process that you can go through where your work can benefit greatly just by putting it in the air and vocalizing it and listening to the sonic resonance. And I think that's one of the things that some writers maybe haven't focused on enough. And it's one of the things that Claire is absolutely expert at. And when you hear the Bone Swans audio recording, I know you're going to be in a treat because I've heard all of these books aloud. I had the privilege of having Claire on Skype read me every single one of these stories, gosh, a little more than a year ago now, right? And let me tell you, you're just in for a real treat, because the stories are so musical, and she's a poet, she's a Riesling Award winning poet, and
the Riesling Award, for people who don't know, is A Risling was a character in a Robert Heinlein story, The Poet of the Spaceways.
Oh, nobody ever told me that. I should have looked it up. Thank you.
Well, you know, you just win them.
I don't know the provenance.
And the story title, by the way, is The Green Hills of Earth.
That I knew was a Heinlein title. And then there's a hymn that also is called that. And I don't know which came first, the hymn or the Heinlein.
The Heinlein.
Okay.
Oh, actually, no. Maybe the hymn and Heinlein did a number.
It's very likely.
Yes.
But it's hard to tell sometimes, the 70s being what they were.
And hymns being so, you know, easy to write. But the point is that, you know, because you have this background in poetry, because you write such a mellifluous line, and because you're such a good performer, it's just the perfect trifecta of performativity. So,
I did have a new appreciation reading my own work aloud after reading other work aloud for the last year and a half, and thinking, well, you know, it is at least fun. There are weird sentences that feel good in the mouth, and that does count for something.
Yes. We a person who passed on about a year and a month ago, Simon Lokely, my show used to be on 5 to 7, and Simon was 7 to 9. And Simon would read James Joyce on the air and stuff like that. And when you, I mean, that's not simple.
No.
Samuel Beckett, James Joyce.
Oh, Beckett's lovely.
Oh, God. It just
nightmarish, but lovely.
Yeah, but it just rolls in the mouth. And who knows how much of James Joyce is Beckett?
But was he reading, like, Finnegan's Wake or something?
Yes.
Like that? Okay, that,
yes.
That's what I was thinking.
Joyce in a hotel room reciting and Beckett writing it down. And there's a very famous story about how and they would get into arguments because these Irish, and they would get into these arguments about stuff, and Joyce just said, "You will, you know, write what I say. You will not deviate anymore." It's like, okay, and eventually maybe the next day there's a knock on the door, somebody delivering food, and Joyce says, "Enter and serve." It's in the book. It's in Finnegan's Wake. Because Beckett was going to show him. And he did, and still there. That's a Simon Lokely story. And Simon can read that stuff. How he was able, he would hold court at a pub downtown Manhattan. An Irish pub, of course. And do his performances of this stuff. I'm going to have to rebroadcast some of Simon's stuff. Anyhow, sorry. I'm very tired. And I'm doing stream of consciousness babbling.
Soon you'll start rhyming.
That's right.
It'll be like Edward Lear meets James Joyce meets a little Virginia Woolf.
That works for me.
And then it'll be Tom Lear and Rickety Tickety Tin. It'll be great.
And Jigglypuff. And with a little Jigglypuff.
Oh, that's because you're here.
Yes. You know, that's how I run performances.
It's not too late to get that water. But anyway. I had some cogent question, but no, I don't. Tell me. Did we even discuss the World Fantasy Award? We mentioned it, but
Hernandez did the kind man.
But it is the collection Bone Swans,
yes,
for which you won, and not by the way, other awards like the Nebulas and the Hugos, they don't have best collections. They
That's
have
correct.
Best editors, is as close as it gets.
Right. The Locus has a collection award?
Do they?
I think so. Locus does a collection?
Gosh, I would just have to look it up online.
It would make sense if they did. It would make sense. But that's a very cool award. And also, people have to realize it is very difficult. You both have accomplished it. But it is very, very difficult for short story writers to get a book out there without a novel in the contract.
Yes, and now we're trying to figure out how to do the opposite.
Yes.
Yes. But I think it's hard either way.
No, if you have a novel, you can find an agent. You can offer it, at least, to an agent. And an agent is going, oh, novel, I can shop that around here and there. You go to an agent and you say, yes, I write short stories for wonderful places like Mythic Delirium and Cross Genres. You know, and how much, you know, if they're paying really well, you might get $150 for that story, which means the agent, if they're taking as much as 15%, is going to get $20.
Yes. Well, lucky for me.
They're not going to work for you real hard for that $20.
Lucky for me, Mike Allen, who started with publishing, well, I don't know what his origin story is, but he published a print magazine called Mythic Delirium. Then it became an online magazine, but he would occasionally release things from the Clockwork Phoenix anthology. He's now up to number 5, and the only criteria for those are Tales of Beauty and Strangeness. Now, I had published every story in the collection of Bone Swans except the title story, and one of them had been published by a small press that went down before they were even printing, basically. So he had mentioned when I was writing that story and in the process of editing it, as an editor and a friend, he said, oh, I think I would have edited that differently. And so after the small press went down, I went to him and I said, I want to kind of re-release this. I think it's pretty good. It was the Big Baja. I think it's pretty good. It's weird. It was the best thing to date I had written. And I said, what were some of your editing ideas I'd really like to hear? And he comes back to me and he said, okay, I see that you want to self-publish this, but what would you say just doing an experiment and putting together a short story collection and offering it as one of the higher level rewards for the next Clockwork Phoenix anthology fundraiser? And yeah. I said, okay, sure. And so we did this, but it was an experiment for him and for me. But I have to tell you, he is one of the most ethical, energetic, like hardworking and on time publishers, editors, and writers I know. He's just on top of things all the time, and ambitious and generous, and I mean, none of this would have happened without him.
Bravo. And brava.
Thank you.
The World Fantasy Award hasn't given her award yet. They gave her an IOU because it doesn't exist yet.
Well, that's standard, actually. But,
well, but they're getting rid of the Lovecraft bust.
They're getting rid of that horrible, wonderful, horrible bust of it became very controversial because Lovecraft was a horrid human being. But the bust of the award, people can Google it up and see what it looks like. It's not very flattering.
No.
It's not supposed to be.
It's sort of like the silly putty version of, you know, if you took H.P. Lovecraft's head and extended it to an El Greco-like length, that is basically
yes,
what
exactly.
You get.
Possibly that was his, like, portrait of his inner landscape. Perhaps he would. Perhaps
at
he would have a
group of madness. Yes. Yes, exactly.
Perhaps he would agree too. I don't know. He wrote many things, it seems, in a fever dream, and that's a fever dream of a face. Nevertheless, it's iconic. I'm glad the iconoclasts have broken with it. I am interested to see what the new award looks like, and I'm very pleased that I'll be in the like first generation to receive it. But I have no idea when and if I'll ever get it. But I kind of like this invisible award with an IOU anyway. I think it's funny.
Yeah. There were some people that were agitating for, let's make it Octavia Butler, because all of a sudden they have discovered Octavia, who was on the show 5 times, so I can talk like that. And it's like, that's just one little problem with that. Octavia never wrote a single fantasy story in her life. She wrote science fiction. And one of the few who actually was in one subgenre over the other. We don't have to get into the argument where that line begins and ends. She wrote SF, not fantasy.
One could argue Lovecraft wrote horror, though.
Well, of course he did.
So I don't know. Why not Octavia then?
Because horror is a subset of fantasy.
I could contend science fiction is a subset of fantasy.
And I would not contest that. I would say fantasy is the great taxonomy. Fantasy's at the top. It's all imaginative literature, and it all falls within the rubric of fantasy. Therefore, science fiction is a form of fantasy literature. I totally agree. But when you get into the marketing of it, which is where the term science fiction science fiction created by Hugo Gernsback and science fiction by John W. Campbell, they were, and speculative fiction by, any hands raised? Robert Heinlein. Yeah, a little surprise there. People forget that Robert Heinlein, I always say it on the air, but Robert Heinlein coined the term speculative fiction in the 40s. They're talking about something different. They're talking about a marketing term. On what shelf will this go in a store? And the World Fantasy Award is very specific about being high fantasy.
Oh, well, I don't know about that. I mean, Kelly Link's collection was up, and I wouldn't call her... She's weird... Weird fantasy. She's usually contemporary, modern, with the weird inserted.
And weird is what Lovecraft is all about. Weird tales.
And also nominated for the Pulitzer at the same time, right? Am I remembering right that this collection is also Pulitzer nominated? So she's definitely literary as well.
All I'm saying is I wouldn't object to an Octavia. That's all I'm saying. But we can be whatever.
I know what I want for... Have they said what it will be?
I think something more abstract, if I remember right.
I don't know. I only saw early ideas and reasons why they wouldn't do. So I've not been following it since.
Not that I've spoken to anybody official about this knowingly, but I would say a dragon, because every cult, and each year a different one. One year a Chinese dragon, another year, an Irish dragon. Almost every single culture has a dragon or verm, or something like that, and that's definitely, you don't find dragons outside of fantasy literature.
Interesting.
It's pretty definitive. You can have so much fun with it, with a different artist and a different concept of a dragon every year.
That would certainly be interesting. We will see what happens. I will let you know as soon as I know, but you'll probably know before me.
No, probably not. I expect you to be posting it on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, so...
Or two of the three, possibly only one of them.
Yeah, there we go. Well, you know what? It's come to the time where we should hear you read.
All right.
Go. Prove yourself. Prove that you can write. Prove that you can read.
Well, Ellen Datlow is putting out a new anthology very soon called Mad Hatters and March Hares.
Which she will be on this show on February 18th to promote.
And she'll probably do a much better job than I am.
And also Bestiary, her new, that just came out last week.
Okay. I have not yet read it or picked it up. But Mad Hatters and March Hares, as the title suggests, are all stories based in or around Lewis Carroll's Wonderland and Looking Glass. So when I had an opportunity to kind of create an idea and submit it and see if she liked it, I came up with the idea of the Wabe. As I was reading both Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, there's a bit in Through the Looking Glass that goes like this: "And the Wabe is the grass plot round a sundial, I suppose," said Alice, surprised at her own ingenuity. And then Humpty Dumpty is the one she's talking to, and he responds, "Of course it is. It's called Wabe, you know, because it goes a long way before it and a long way behind it." And I thought, Wabe, what a great name for a world. And if I had a world called the Wabe, it's shaped like a sundial with a gnomon in the middle. That's a huge mountain made of glass. And the logic of the world is around the sundial. And that way I don't have to adhere to the logic of the Looking Glass or Wonderland, but both the Looking Glass and Wonderland are still parts of the universe that it occupies. So my story is called Lily White and the Thief of Lesser Night. And I wrote it because I really have always loved the White Queen, because she does this thing that I do. And that is, she'll freak out about something long before it happens. And then when it happens, it's not a big deal. So she starts crying, and Alice is very concerned, and she says, "Why are you crying?" And she says something like, "Oh, because in 5 minutes I'm going to cut my hand open on that scissor." And Alice says, "Well, don't make such a fuss about it now. You haven't done it yet, and it may not happen." And of course it does happen, and she's bleeding, spurting gouts of arterial blood, and Alice is freaking out. "Oh my gosh, you cut your hand." She's like, "I know." And she's just sort of calmly bandaging it. So I liked this, and I thought of the gift of forefeeling, we're calling it. And I like the idea of a young white queen and a young red queen sisters in a place called the Wabe before they become who they become in the later stories. So this kind of, I'm going to excerpt it from the middle. They live at the bottom of the Wabe, in the southern part of the sundial, where there's only greater night, but never lesser night, because the shadow of the sundial does not fall in the southern part of the Wabe. In all the other parts of the Wabe, they get 1 hour of lesser night, and then they get greater night as well. Their mother is called the Hetch, and she sort of is a witch that keeps the borogoves, which is these groves of dead birds, back behind. And people come to the Hetch with problems. She also keeps a garden full of vorpal roses, which are very obstreperous and vocal roses, who have a enmity with the two sisters, but it's also like a truce. They're frenemies, the vorpal roses and the girls. So we're going to start with some visitors who come to visit the Hetch. The thorns had caught two Cheshires. Although Lily White only saw one at first, the other being mostly invisible. The Cheshire Bear was not invisible, though in bad shape. Once a dapper and debonair bear, with sequined speckled waistcoat, daintily glittering tutu, and tricorn with a cockade of peonies affixed to the front, now he was shaggy, grayed out, matted, the yellow of his great eyes suggesting jaundice rather than pots of honey. He gasped for breath, and the vorpal roses had taken no small pleasure in raking his fine clothing to ribbons. "Oh, how he groans!" cried the Baronne Henriette de Snoy with glee. She was pale pink and carmine, vigorous with petals, and she smelled divine. "Oh, how he moans for his mama bear!" "A bear should show more dignity!" chortled General Jacques Minot, preening like a butterfly upon her glossy foliage. A cluster of Jeanne d'Arcs shrilled, "Get him off! Get him off! He's bleeding all over our hips!" Ruby Red, who loved animals and hated roses, charged out of the cottage behind Lily White, blade raised. When the shadow of the vorpal sword fell upon Lady Banks, Lady Hillingdon, and the Lady of Shalott, they squeaked and emitted a strong musk of perfumed terror. Distress furled their yellow and apricot petals to tight buds, which they tried to hide beneath their leaves. "Put up that sword, thou viper!" Mrs. Sam Houston scolded Ruby Red, bristling self-righteously against this imminent attack. "We're only playing. We're not but little flowers, and he's a big monstrous bear." Taking this as their cue, the vorpal roses released the imprisoned Cheshires, whipping them out of the briary snarl with thorn-studded vines and decanting them onto the gravel walkway. The ragged bear sobbed like a mock turtle with a bone in his throat and did not rise, but the second Cheshire, reluctantly emerging mouth first from her vanishment, smiled with relief and patted herself down with tiny hands. "Why, you're a monkey!" Ruby Red exclaimed, lowering her sword and sounding half her age. "I didn't think Cheshires came in, monkey." "Pygmy marmoset, if you please," replied the Cheshire monkey, clearly resigned to being mislabeled henceforth. "What brings you to the Hetch of the Borogoves?" Lily White asked. "And what's wrong with your bear?" The Cheshire monkey's head body trembled. "Oh," she cried, "oh, oh, oh, can't you see? He's been snatched." Before either sister could ask what this meant, the poor bear let out another wheezing moan and stretched his mouth into a terrible rictus. The Cheshire monkey rushed up to him and put her clever little paws on both of his cheeks and squeezed with all her might. "Empty beehives," she shouted, "rotten river trout, bad berries, sad thoughts, damn you bear, think sad thoughts, don't you dare smile." But her paws were small. The bear's gaping mouth might easily have fit her whole body, fez and all. The Cheshire Bear rattled his head back and forth. His companion clung as long as she could, but there was nothing she could do. That rictus grin only grew and grew as the rest of the bear's gray body faded out entirely. The mouth went last, as was the way of the Cheshires, but instead of that glittering crescent of teeth, winking and blinking in the air like a trickster sickle, Lily White and Ruby Red had a flash of empty gums that scattered a few last drops of blood like a passing rain cloud. Then it, too, disappeared. The Cheshire Monkey lay where she fell and sobbed, tail beating gravel like a gavel. "Oh, and he will never return," the Cheshire Monkey sobbed. "He will never not ever return, for our teeth are the first and last of us, and his are gone, gone, gone. He's been snatched." "Yes," said Lily White impatiently. "You said that already. But who snatched his teeth, or what, if it's a what, and why?" "We don't know," the Cheshire Monkey shrieked, leaping agitatedly to all fours and then up and down in place. "We have never seen our foe's face, this night hunter who stalks our village. When we lay us down to sleep, we are smiling fools, Toms and Maudlins all in the lordly lofts of Bedlam. But when we wake, another of us has been snatched. Sans Muller, sans Cuspid, sans Incisor, sans everything. And once the snatched ones vanish, they're gone forever." "Can't you just not vanish?" asked Ruby Red, weeping red tears in sympathy. The Cheshire Monkey gave her a scornful scowl. "You try holding your breath the rest of your life. Cheshires are made to fade in and out on a smile. We're a begimbled race, half whole, and that's all there is to it. But so long's we have our teeth, we can come back. That's why we're here," she insisted. "We've come, or I've come, I guess, now that bear is gone, to beg the hetch of the Borogoves to seek out our enemy and kill it dead before it murders us all." Lily White and Ruby Red took just a moment to study each other from the corners of their eyes. "Oh," Ruby Red said casually, "we'll go. No need to bother Mimsy about it. She's got the motto to maintain and a caterpillar to incubate." Lily White had already dashed to the cottage, meaning to gather up their things, but found the door locked fast against her. She tested it twice, then looked around for clues. Mother never locked the door without a reason. After a brief survey, she noticed the two packs nestled beneath the stoop and checked the contents. Drink me's and eat me's aplenty. Gauze and theriac for wounds, pads for menstruation, plus one large bottle of jub-jub oil. "Mimsy says it's okay," Lily White called out, settling her own pack on her back. She dutifully trotted the other to Ruby Red, who slung it over one shoulder, jaunty style, and sheathed her vorpal sword at her side with an ostentatious hissy click. "Lead on, monkey," she commanded, grinning. "We shall follow, across the motto and into the dial, even unto the very nest of thy bandit tooth-snatch we go. Off with their heads!" "I really hope," Lily White thought privately, "it doesn't have more than one." Not so long ago, Cheshire Town had been the gaudiest, chaoticest, pranciest place in the Wabe. It was built around the VIII of the dial, which, as you know, is the number associated with flimflammers, frauds, and fools, and looked more like a carnival than a settlement. Pennants, balloons, colored lights, a house of love with swans, a house of horror also with swans, even a Ferris wheel. All dull now.
Sorry.
You're fine. All dull now and silent. Those of its denizens who had not fled were in hiding, and those in plain sight had already been snatched. Like the Cheshire Bear, these grayed-out and grim victims had not yet surrendered to their inevitable vanishment. The Cheshire Hyena, the sisters noted, had wired her bone-crushing jaws shut, but to no avail. Her spots were disappearing one by one from her saffron-piled fur, her mane a ghost ruff, unmoved by the breeze. "I must see to my family," said the Cheshire Monkey worriedly, and scurried off to clamber up a Tulgi fir. The Tulgi fir, named after botanist explorer Professor Theolodia Tulgi, is the second tallest tree in the Wabe, dwarfed only by the Tum-Tum tree, which is most notorious for never being where you saw it last. The palatial purple trunk of the Tulgi fir, with its bristling cobra nest of branches, was massive enough to host whole colonies of pygmy marmosets, whole generations. Lily White and Ruby Red awaited the Cheshire Monkey's return in the undershade. They waited long enough that the VIII of the dial fell under the shadow of Mount Nomon, and Cheshire Town took its turn of lesser night. Lily White and Ruby Red shivered and exclaimed aloud, delighted. Where they lived on the motto, they had greater night, but no lesser night, for the mountain's shadow did not touch the Southlands. "Look, there's the looking-glass constellation!" Ruby Red pointed between a break in the Tulgi needles, where night striped a precise slice of sky. "And see," Lily White cried, "the timeless rabbit and the portal maid." Occupied thus with celestial concerns, the sisters hardly noticed the shadow passing until lesser dawn had all but surrendered to the dazzle of 1 a.m. When it was light again, the girls got antsy and hungry. No wonder they had breakfast twice up north. "Where's the Cheshire Monkey?" Ruby Red asked. "I'm about to eat and eat me. Then I'll be tall enough to look down into the tree and shake her right out of it." "Oh, save it," Lily White advised. "Mimsy wouldn't have packed it just for snacking on." They lingered an idle minute longer. Ruby Red huffed and stamped. Lily White replatted one of her white braids. The Cheshire Monkey did not crawl back down. "I'll holler for her," Lily White offered, craning her neck and opening her mouth. But before a single word escaped, she slumped. She stumbled. She fell upon her fundament. Stunned and sick, she stared at nothing. Pale, pale. Everything was pale, inside and out. Queasy, squirmy, maggoty pale. Suddenly her sister was kneeling before her, tracing the vorpal scars on her face, reawakening the scorch and scrape of them. Memory countered foresight. Lily White exited the future via the past and re-entered the present. Ruby Red patted her on the shoulder, whispering, "Your eyes got pearls in them, Egg White. Something bad's about to happen?" Lily White nodded, mute. Ruby Red took a deep breath, and Lily White automatically did the same, having forgotten until that moment how. "Let's go see," her sister urged, "right now." Ruby Red always wanted the worst over quickly, ever since she had rushed into the thorns. For Lily White, the worst always happened before it actually happened, and maybe this was better all around. "All right," she agreed. Ruby Red grinned weakly. "At least we're braced for it, eh?" But she could not be, not really. Lily White had not been. Whatever it was, there could be no bracing against it. She let her sister go first, not only because Ruby Red insisted and was quicker anyway, but because Lily White wanted the phantom pearls of future feeling to clear from her eyes, hard to see through all that milky murk. When Ruby Red screamed, Lily White sprang to action. She leapt for the lowest-hanging branch of the Tulgey Fir, bare feet scrabbling for purchase on the shaggy purple trunk, and swung herself up. About 5 or 6 levels high into the coniferous purple needles, a carnage of limbs greeted her. Ruby Red clung to a branch, belly down, head pressed to the bark, shaking and crying. Her hair spilled like magma across her face. Whatever had snatched the pygmy marmosets had been greeted with a fight. The pygmy marmosets had preferred violent death to vanishment, knowing that if they died before their teeth were taken, their bodies would remain. Poor things. Bravery had not kept their mouths inviolate. Even their tiny teeth had not been deemed too small to take. Obviously, Lily White hypothesized rapidly, her thoughts clear and untroubled, the snatch had only just visited. This patch of blood was barely cool. It must have lurked in the highest branches of the Tulgey Fir until a lesser night, then got right to business as the sisters examined the stars. Perhaps the Cheshire Monkey, whose little fez was nowhere to be found among all these strewn corpses, espying the snatch upon her return, had crept upon it all slithy-like and clung to its back as her brethren fell around her, knowing her only hope was to see where it fled with the light. Lily White shook her head. "She might have cried warning," she said. "We were right below, vorpal sword and all. But Cheshires," she added, "never do the sensible thing." "Oh, they're so small," Ruby Red sobbed. "They're so small and so many. And poor Hyena and Bear. Oh, I can't breathe. Oh." Lily White scooted down the branch and laid her hand upon her sister's shoulder. She drew a deep breath, and Ruby Red automatically did the same, having forgotten until that moment how. "I'm going below," Lily White said when Ruby Red seemed calm again. "I think the Cheshire Monkey rode hag on that thing, and I want to see if she left a clue." Without answering, Ruby Red wiped her red eyes and dropped straight down. She landed on her feet, as she always did. Lily White followed more carefully. When she found her sister pacing and possibly trampling evidence, she gnawed her tongue against remonstrance. Ruby Red needed a job, a distraction, and Lily White needed a place to work in peace. "You up for a tweedle?" she asked casually. Ruby Red lit up. "I'll tweedle you a Barrasco," she cried, executing a fierce pirouette. "I'll tweedle you a Brickfielder, a Brew-Brew. Say the word, and I'll run Wittershins around the wabe and return with the Cat-O-Nine Cordonazos. I'll have you a sundowner by sunset, Lily White." Lily White grasped her sister's arm. "Good, go, fly. Tweedle up a herd of hard winds and drive them before you. Find me. I'll be moving slowly, tracking from the ground." She grinned and quoted her favorite of mother's mottos, "Festina lente." Snorting, Ruby Red retorted, "Vita in motu." Then she was off, Ruby Red ran even faster backwards than she did forwards. In her wake, silence, Lily White bent down and found her first clue, a fez.
Called Shadow Puppets. I don't believe, I don't know whether it has been released or not. I found it online, and I'm really, really, because I was, it's too easy to just play, you know, White Rabbit. It's way too easy.
I just looked up her website. She's a possible fairy princess from Australia.
Ooh.
Self-described fairy princess, or?
It's in her bio.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, so if...
She's from Australia, and she's possibly a fairy princess.
She's a Strine.
Could be.
She's a Strine, yeah.
Or she is there now. Who knows where she started out? But yeah. She's only 22, so she can't have gone far.
Yeah.
Or she could have.
If she's fairy, there's no telling.
Right. And what's 22 in fairy years, right?
Yeah, exactly. Let's see. When True Thomas went for his 7 years, served his 7 years in fairy, when he came back, 7 years had passed, but it didn't necessarily have to be that way.
It could have been 200.
Yeah.
As an Outlander. You never know when you're going to go under the mound, if you're going to come out at all, first of all, or how the world will have changed when you do.
Yes. Yes. And why are they always under mounds? I guess it's just the British or Celtic tradition there.
I mean, I've read some theories.
Yes.
But let's not get into that.
Oh.
I think some of the theories I've read is because, okay, so when a conquering people come into a land, they drive the natives of the land into the hills, basically. They drive, uh-huh. And then you start making up stories about the other people who live in the hills and people who are raiding your cattle barn and, you know, doing kind of guerrilla attacks. You make up all sorts of spiritual reasons for that happening. I think I read that in Alphabet Versus the Goddess when I was 15 years old. So probably, I don't know what the historical anthropological reason is.
I know somebody who probably does, and I think he's calling in fact. But but the call just went away. But it doesn't mean he stopped calling. It means that our system dumped the call because it does that. But we have a former CUNY professor who loves to call this program and give the etymology of everything.
My friend Amal has studied some of the idea of the way, you know, the British got their fairy tales and how there's been a kind of the exoticization of the East and different tales that started far, far away in the East and far older than we think. And then they became religions changed hands and then religions turned into myth and then myth turned into fairy tale. But they all have a long provenance, so...
And she has a fine, fine voice for singing songs of fairy.
Amal?
Yes.
Oh, she does. Smoky, silvered alto of glory.
Barbara and I were at a ReaderCon, and we were going to go to my favorite event at ReaderCon, which is the Meet the Authors party, mm-hmm. where everybody has stickers that has a line from their story in it. And we were... It was in a new hotel at the time, and we took a wrong turn to try to find the room where that party was. And in there was, pronounce the whole name, Amal El-Motar?
Amal El-Motar.
Okay. And Ellen Kushner. And I almost said Kushner because I call her Ellen Kushner, but because there's going to be a Kushner in the White House, I will do Ellen the favor of using the whole name. Jared Kushner. I hope they're no relation. But anyway, that would make her related to Trump because this is like...
She has said, as far as I know publicly, they are no relation.
I think she needs to buy a billboard. And just saying, Ellen. But...
But Caitlin Paxton was there, April Grant, and actually Claire was in that room too.
Were you?
Patty Templeton, yes. Yeah. This was an important day for Carlos, but yes. We all did song circles.
Oh, right.
And so
okay.
This was the sea shanty.
Okay,
moment.
Yes, that's yeah. right. You yeah. were there. And Barbara and I we walked into this room. We never got to the party and also didn't have to because I was carrying a flask of a type of bourbon.
I remember that flask being passed around. You were very generous, sir.
Yes, absolutely. That's the point of a flask in a place like that. That was a magical moment. It really was. I loved that party, that event.
Can't agree more. I had been going through a really difficult time in my life at that moment. This was before Claire and I, started our first collaboration, and you know, I was really in a de profundis kind of moment where art meant very little to me, and I wasn't sure if I was going to pull out of it. I was questioning a great deal of my life, and I sat between Caitlin Paxton and April Grant during one of those sea shanties. And they harmonized perfectly between me in stereo, this beautiful minor chord.
Oh, God.
It literally made me weep. Literally, a tear fell right out of my eye at that moment.
It would have put a pall on the room, I think. But what I would not have given to have my little microphone, which can do a 360 recording in the middle of that circle. And that was the first time that I heard a version of... not Tamlin, Matty Grove, done in an Appalachian.
Oh, that was Caitlin Paxton.
Oh, is that
that? Caitlin was the director, artistic director of the Ottawa Storytellers, but she plays banjo and harp. So Caitlin and Amal and I sing in a group together sometimes called the Banjo Apocalypse Crinoline Troubadours. So we all sing together, and in fact, Amal just came to Westerly, Rhode Island from Ottawa last month when I put together a concert to benefit our local food pantry, and she recited one of her poems, and she also sang with me one of the songs
I want this
I'd
on
written.
The radio, you know.
Sure. Well, we're here on the radio.
If we have to find a studio, perform live downstairs at 388 Atlantic or something like that. I want that.
Caitlin and Amal and I have written a song cycle called Ballads from a Distant Star, which are all science fiction ballads based on Appalachian ballads. And so we would love someday to crowdfund enough to have an album. We all love to perform.
But this could be a live performance. Okay.
Certainly,
on the
but
internet.
We'd have to pay the girls to come down here. You know, they both live in Canada, Toronto and Ottawa.
It's Canada, yeah. Okay.
So it's just like, unless I could compensate them for coming, I'm happy to arrange it, but I need to be able to pay them, I think.
Well, then you're talking about, start.
I know exactly what I need to do. I have lots of projects.
In 20 minutes, when we're off the air, assuming Lister gets here. Lister, are you here? Nothing. Shall we take the phone call?
You can do whatever you like.
Well, then put on your headphones.
Okay.
Because if you don't put on your headphones, you can't hear the call. Hi there, you're on the air.
Do you realize that this is musical heaven?
Yes.
I mean, this is amazing. First of all, Claire Cooney, I have to tell you, my very, very dear friend, you mentioned a friend. You mentioned so many friends in the last couple of minutes. You mentioned April Grant.
Oh, I love April.
My God, I met her at a music camp many years ago. She used to run a ballad swap an hour before dinner every night.
She's so amazing.
And the only thing... By the way, she's the only person I know who can sing the chivalrous shark.
Which is enough of a tongue twister.
I know. But there is so much about her that is amazing. She and I used to have discussions of comparative child ballad variations. And I must tell you, when you mention Appalachian Matty Groves, now you also happen to mention, by the way, and I have to, I'm not a name dropper, but the way that I found out about
you
and your marvelous stories through a published poet friend of mine named Sandy Leibowitz.
Oh, wow, yes. I think we're Facebook friends.
Yes, Sandy mentioned you, and every time I call, she said, have you read the latest Claire Cooney story? And then I let her rave for 10 minutes.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Sandy.
Now, I have to ask you, did you grow up listening or loving child ballads and stuff like that?
Gracious. You know, Caitlin later...
Let's just for the listeners explain that Child Ballads is named after a guy named Child who collected all of these tales and that were turned into ballads and songs.
305 in number. By the way, James, I have to recommend something to you, and I have something that I'm going to give you. It is a little slim volume that a very dear friend who was actually an ex-girlfriend of mine from 30 years ago put together called Body Counts, Death in the Child Ballads. She took 150.
I need that.
Oh, okay, then I've got one for you, too.
Oh, excellent.
No, I'm quite serious. What she did was she took 156 of the 305, and she decided, let's find out who died and how. And so she goes through 156. She gives the appropriate verses. She doesn't borderize. She doesn't sanitize. She doesn't tone it down. She gives the verses, and then she gives you the body counts, whether it's one, several, many, or countless thousands.
I mean, Matty Groves has a 2.5 at least.
Yes, at least 2.5.
Half a death?
In some birds.
He gets struck a mortal blow, but he doesn't die at that moment.
By the way, tell me this.
And she gets buried on top because she's of noble kin.
Yeah, that's right. And she gets decapitated, and he kicks her head against the wall.
Excellent.
In one of the versions, yeah.
But I want to know, tell me again, by the way, do you prefer Miss Cooney or Claire or what?
You may call me Claire because you're so nice.
Yeah, well, that's thank you.
I say CSE.
You can call me that,
because I'm trying to promote the sale of...
I call her Sideria. Sideria, I strongly suggest.
Because I'm trying to promote the idea that people have to go and look for CSE Cooney. Bone Swans is the name of the book. And also Carlos Hernandez's book, The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Santeria.
Oh, that's a great book.
Oh, it's so good, and he's so good. But I wanted to answer your question really quickly.
Yes.
In that mostly Caitlin Paxson, whose parents were folk musicians and who ran a music shop, introduced me to many of the ballads I know. I grew up mostly, I would say, on the folk music of the 60s and 70s, which my parents loved, and also Sondheim and Broadway, and then later came into my folk ballads, and recently really enjoyed Anais Mitchell's Child Ballads, the five that she's taken and rewritten. And when Caitlin and I first were discussing all these ballads, she kind of gave me all the ballads of the world that she knew and loved. And that's when I started listening. And that's when we conceived of Ballads from a Distant Star, which is the idea that if an alien kind of force came down and bargained with a mining company to trade its miners and basically body snatch the miners in exchange for advanced alien tech, the ballads that the miners would have written on their way up to the planet and what they'd written on the planet. So we started writing the song cycle of these ballads.
But that's such an overused trope.
You know, if this were football, I would have to penalize you for piling on. You know, when six guys jump on a guy, you would have to be penalized 600 yards. Do you realize what you've done for this starved ballad buff?
Oh.
I just came back from the UK, where, among other things, we spent 3 days doing nothing but swapping ballads.
Oh.
We were in a Welsh castle.
We being the revelers?
Yeah, no. A bunch of people. I actually went to Britain to attend an urban legends conference up in Cheshire. Hmm. And but we got to do some wassailing and just all kinds of good stuff. I know you're probably running almost out of time.
Yes.
So may I ask you, Claire, how does one get in touch with you? Do you have an email that I can contact you so we can pursue the subject of ballads more? Because I have such information to give you on the provenance of where fairy tales came from. And
sure, wonderful. You can contact Jim. I do have a website, csecooney.com, and
yes.
The Banjo Apocalypse Crinoline Troubadours, who did or are doing the Ballads from a Distant Star. It's Backed Troubadours, BACTroubadours.com, and you can see some of our, we performed under this banner, and so some of our songs and or poetry or performance pieces, which were not all Distant Star ballads, are there, but some of the Distant Star ballads are there.
Is csecooney.com your email? That's what I'd like to get.
It's my website, and you can contact me through that, or you can contact me through Jim, just because I don't really want to give my email
on the air. I understand that. I would never ask that. But I would certainly love to know more about this Appalachian Matty Grove. Because
there are also some professionally recorded versions.
Oh, sure.
Of that.
Yes, and I could get you. I could ask my friend Caitlin, who could tell me more, and I could tell
actually,
you.
Actually, I know those.
Oh, right, and Jim, because why go through a third
only
party?
And it's really weird because how do you do Lords and all that when it's set in Appalachia, but
well, it's that,
or Appalachia.
Well, James, I will tell you that sometime, because some of the versions of Little Musgrave, or Number 81, as we call it, some of those versions can be very, very interesting in terms of lords and dukes. And in Appalachia, he's the Lord Darnall, or right. Daniel is the Duke of England. That's a whole other convolution. Anyway, I know you probably have to go. This has been
like
such fun. And let me just say, Claire, to paraphrase or to say what the great Oxford Don said, you and your poetry and your stories and music, you are a joy of perfect measure.
Wow, thank you so much.
I want to talk to you much more about ballads.
Okay, I would love to hear everything you have to say.
And if you see April Grant, tell her Robert says hello.
Robert says hello, I'll do that.
Okay. Robert, yes. Come to ReaderCon. Y'all hang out there.
You know, I may actually do that. Do you know where it's going to be, when it's going to be and where this year?
It's online.
Right? Yeah,
it's in Burlington,
it's in
Massachusetts.
Burlington.
And
it's early
it's in
July, as usual?
Early July, yeah.
Yes.
You will be there, Claire?
I'm planning on it, but I can't say for certain.
Well, I will tell you, one of the things that I
okay,
want
to
do...
as you said,
okay.
We're out of time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Take Bye-bye. Care.
Ah. As I said. But, okay, and, well, we actually are. We've got 3 minutes left because it flies.
It really does.
It really flies. That's why you heard me complaining about how fast 90 minutes goes. But, hey, 3 hours can go really quickly as well. So we need to tell the listeners where they can locate each of your works and websites and stuff like that there.
Well, certainly you can buy both of our books on Amazon.com. I think that Rosarium also...
Yep.
So Rosarium Publishing
right,
is
Rosarium
the
Publishing,
of
that's my publisher, and, you know, go to their website. And
Carlos Hernandez.
Yep.
The Assimilated Cuban's Guide to Quantum Centuria. Bone Swans, I believe you can buy on several websites, Barnes & Noble as well. My
Owl Books.
My...
Amazon.
Waitlist. My personal website, such as it is, WordPress-wise, that I sort of cobbled together is csecooney.com.
And actually, for you, I recommend people can go to Mythic Delirium, buy direct from the publisher.
Does he sell directly from Mythic Delirium?
I think he's got links.
He's got links.
Yeah,
got
but
all
see,
sorts of
but
links.
But when you have links and you put links down and stuff like that, he gets kickbacks.
Oh, excellent.
He'll
well, then
like
by all means, go to Mythic Delirium and give Mike Allen kickbacks. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, and for that matter, both of them are in Clockwork Phoenix 5.
We're the Book of May.
Yeah, which is just, and if you enjoyed last week's show. You know, Mike, you're going to have to start paying me a royalty or something. Because last week's show, Rob Cameron was here, and he read his story from Clockwork Phoenix and all that.
A fine story.
Yeah. It is. It really is. And I'm going to have a... we're going to have to replay a lot of... That was a particularly spectacular event.
Yeah.
So, Carlos, have you a website?
I do. It sucks. Don't go to it. I fix it someday, I promise.
Yeah, I'm that way about ourwolf.com as well. It's very 90s, my website. and not 2090s. I started it in 1994 before the web became commercial, before .com was a thing.
Right.
So it's really that old. But it serves its purpose, particularly for the reading series.
You know, I just thought of something. We're out of time, unfortunately, but we have an Alice in Wonderland song. We have a Jub Jub song.
Oh, we have the Jub Jub. We should have sang the Jub Jub.
Oh,
well. Sorry, you don't get the Jub Jub tonight.
Snicka,
yeah. Snicka, snack, snicka, snicka, snack, snack.
Yes, I went to a lovely little reading at a gaming store where saw this performed.
Right.
And we're going to have to talk about just doing a music show.
Yeah. I'm there if you want me.
Yeah, okay. Well, I want you.
Okay,
so,
great. Perfect.
So we'll be there. And hopefully we'll be here. So, everybody, time to say this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, C.S.E. Cooney, COONEY.
Yes.
NEY.
Anyway.
It's NEY. And Carlos Hernandez. And it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Everybody needs to stay tuned. And I mean, you need to stay tuned for Lister with Burn Baby Burn Clapper coming your way just any moment now. And I will be back next week. Yeah, I'm still 1:30 to 3. Things will change in February for fundraising, Lister. But everybody, be good to each other. We deserve it. You deserve it. There's tough times ahead, and so you need to be good in order for us to weather it. Thank you for listening. Visit my Facebook group on called Hour of the Wolf, duh, and talk to you next week. Good morning.
Burn, baby, burn. other places will hit.
Number one.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea. Beirut, can't forget Haiti. Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah. My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I tossed the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
sound like in plain sight. Feel the earth moving, cry out, don't blind yourself. Don't take not the part of it. You get to shut your eyes to the world you're living in. Remember the bird starts with a spark. Spread some light. Now these words when they get fire, you bless the chosen few.
They said utopia, looking for Ethiopia, looking for Prestajan in Ethiopia. All of the Arabic, Spanish combinations of Marina and the Gaelic, French and Germanic, Teutonic, Holy Christian King to save Jerusalem from panic. Upon the three-pine circle burning chronic. These are the tales of prophetical fulfilling. These are the historical unveilings of the hidden things. These are the times of documentary God spilling. These are the youth of the earth finding hold on to him. These are the asking, what is the significance of the king? Well, quick, Rastafari is answering. Hey, why I and I chant and sing unto him? Yeah, 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 yeah. He ruled them with a rod of iron and forced to back iron, he back iron. Starting from the Pope and them roll pan Zion. Selassie removed the swagger from them imperial aggression. And prove that a day will come when the inner forces of the lion will overcome and overcome. No matter how them look, them a go come to see it. Wherever, whatever their country, what the bias is lead. Yearly, Selassie, I am tweet. Yeah, yearly, Selassie, I am tweet. They said utopia. Looking for Ethiopia, eh. Looking for Prestajan in Ethiopia. They said utopia, looking for Ethiopia.